I'm Alex.
And I'm Matt, and welcome to our show, Sources and Methods, also online at sourcesandmethods.com. Our first guest for the program is Anand Gopal, a prolific writer, author, journalist, and researcher, and we'll be talking with him about how he got to know Afghanistan and how he wrote his recent book on the country, which received rave reviews from critics and general readers alike. We'll also dive deep on what information sources he's consuming and what he does with that information. This session and more can be downloaded at our website, sourcesandmethods.com.
So before we started, I thought it might be worth, since this is our inaugural episode, talking a little bit about why we're starting the podcast. I happen to listen to a lot of podcasts these days. It kind of passes the time while I'm commuting between place and place. It was kind of interesting. There are some interesting podcasts out there. More and more people are doing them, either as a kind of interview format or simply just kind of talking into a microphone. But it seemed that there were a certain kind of people who were missing, or at least like a kind of guest that I would like to listen to. We're missing from these shows, and also being slightly technically minded or geeky about how I use my computer and you know, how I kind of consume information. I thought it might be a good idea to look into how other people worked, basically, you know, what kinds of things, not only what kinds of things were they consuming and reading and being exposed to, but how they were processing all of this. You know, it's an excuse to talk to people about this in a focused way. Mostly, you know, it's also a way to spread knowledge of certain approaches skills that have proven really useful in my life as a researcher, that, you know, with our that I've spoken to a lot about with our first guest.
This show, like Alex just said, will essentially be examining three things. The first is sources of information. How do our guests get their news, and from what sources? Is it Twitter, blogs, newspapers, news articles online, books, research projects, essays, films, their grandmothers, homeless people? How do they get their information? And the second thing, equally important, is what are the tools that these people, our guests, use to organize, track, retain, etc., all of this information? There are so many applications out there today that can help so many people do these things, and we're going to try and figure out which ones are most useful and why most people and why our guests are using these programs. So in a nutshell, the tagline for the program is interesting people doing interesting things, and what we're trying to figure out is essentially how do our guests receive this information, how do they process this information, and most importantly, how do they use it?
We'll also have shorter episodes in between, usually when we're unable to get someone to speak to us, where we'll kind of talk between ourselves on certain techniques, perhaps, or issues. I guess you'll have to wait to see until we do one of those to see what we actually do.
Our inaugural guest is Anand Gopal. He's best known as a writer and journalist. He's frequently published in magazines and newspapers like the Wall Street Journal, the Christian Science Monitor, Foreign Policy Magazine, and most recently Harper's. He has an article out this month on Kandahar, which we'll discuss later. He's also a fellow at the New America Foundation, and his book, No Good Men Among the Living, was published earlier this year to positive acclaim. But outside of his writing work, he's also up to a whole lot else. He's also a polymath of sorts. He wrote a book on quantum physics, entitled Quantum Theory for the Rest of Us, in 2004, far before he ever traveled to Afghanistan. And he's still involved in a wide array of things outside of publishing that we're going to talk with him about today. Alex and Anand actually first crossed paths back in 2011 in Kandahar. Is that right, Alex?
Actually, it was Kabul. I was, maybe I'm wrong, Anand, but I think I met you at your house at some kind of party you were having. Could that be right?
Yeah, maybe 2010 or something. But I was following Alex for years before that and sending him emails, which he never answered for many years until we met in Kabul.
Yeah, no, it was funny. It was like, yeah, and then everyone was like, "Oh, you should meet Anand. He's a really interesting person. He's doing like similar kinds of things. You should talk to him." And yeah, for some reason, we never met, and we talked a lot once we met, like about the book I just published with my colleague Felix, Mulla Zaif biography, and yeah, Anand has been. One of the more consistently useful writers on Afghanistan. It'll be you should check out the show notes for this episode if there are if you want to get an overview of interesting things that Anand has done. But he wrote a paper for New America Foundation on the Taliban in Kandahar, which is yeah, contains a lot of information. And if you're interested in Afghanistan, it's definitely something that you should read. Yeah, so you'd been involved in things in Afghanistan for a long time, but you finally published your book recently.
Yeah, well, it took me quite a while to put everything together. I think I spent 2 years just on writing and probably more than 2 years on research.
Can you say something a bit about the kind of that kind of overall process? Because certainly, I think you, I don't know when you got the kind of contract to write it, but it was pretty early on. And certainly, as long as I've known you, it seems the book has gone through many different kind of shapes and sizes.
Well, yeah, in fact, I got it, I think I got the contract back in 2009, and for the next, essentially for the next 2 years, I was on the ground researching, which was the easy part in many respects. So the hard part was when I came back home to the US to put it all together. One problem I had was that I'd never written a book before. I'd never written anything longer than probably 5,000 words, so I'd come into it thinking that I could just string together a series of what would be essentially 5,000 word articles and make it into a book, but I found out very quickly that that doesn't really work. And so a lot of that was a learning process for me, which I'm still learning, but that was, I guess, the biggest challenge. And also, the other issue was there was a lot of research that went into the book that was purely desk research, meaning, trawling through LexisNexis archives and finding every instance of a particular village that's in the public record, and finding out that after you've done that, after you spent 2 days doing that, that in fact is another variant of the spelling that you haven't thought of, that you have to go and do it again. So that was very onerous, but I think important because I was able to find out a lot of things that I actually didn't even find out in Afghanistan by doing that.
Yeah, it was funny. I always remember, like, these very late night kind of emails that I get from you, where like you discover that there are three guys in the Taliban, all who have the same name, and then you'd spend like a week figuring out exactly who these three people are and how they're different.
Yeah, and I guess the tragedy of all that is, it at best it ends up as a footnote, an endnote in the book. But there's cases where, for instance, once I found out that there's two different spellings of a guy's name, and because of that, one person was actually confused of being a second person. And was arrested and sent to Guantanamo because of that. So, there's sort of fruitful information to be gleaned from doing that kind of thing.
Did you find that the stuff that you were doing in America, did you find that fun? Did you find it easy? Did you find it interesting or?
I don't know if I would characterize it as fun. I was a bit obsessive about it. Some things are interesting. To be able to go back and look at, let's say, the reporting on Afghanistan in 2002 was very fun and interesting, because one of the things that struck me was that the quality of the reporting in 2002 is so far superior to the quality of reporting these days. And in large part, I think that's because people were able to move around much more freely back then. And so, you know, you would have, let's say, an attack or a night raid or something that happened in some village in Kandahar, and journalists would actually be able to go there and interview the people because there was no insurgency at the time, so it was quite safe for them to do so. So, but by reading those kinds of articles, I actually learned quite a bit about the country. You know, these days, if there's some kind of like a night raid or a controversial incident somewhere out in Kandahar, we really have no idea what actually happens because nobody's able to go out there.
But do you think they are actually not able? I mean, there's a lot more happening outside Kandahar, and you know, stuff in, I don't know, there are a whole bunch of stuff happening in very safe parts of the country that, I can't remember the time that I've last read an interesting article about what's going on in Herat, which is like the safest place in the world.
Right.
Do you think it's the safety or just people love living in Kabul?
Well, no, you're right. I think it's definitely a little bit of both. It's still possible to go out and do the kind of reporting that was happening in 2002. It's just that it's much more difficult to do it. And so, I mean, there's a higher bar. So I think that dissuades certain types of people. There's a tendency that's been, I guess, partly as a result of all that, where people tend to like to speak to those who sound just like them. So they like to speak to English speakers, or they like to talk to people who are from the cities. And that's definitely an issue. But I would say at least it was much easier to go out and do it back in 2002. And so it was easier to take advantage of it.
I'm wondering, Anand, if, it's something I experienced a little bit of living in Kabul, and I'm sure you did too, given sort of recent publications. I'm wondering, both with the book and also, you know, what you're talking about, the quality of reporting, did you run into, you know, what some people have referred to as Afghan war fatigue, just kind of a general lack of interest in really hearing, you know, okay, so there was a night raid, you know, somewhere even safe like Herat or Bamiyan or something. Was the interest level also a factor in any of your work and the book, or not so much?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would say that at least the American public, which I could speak more confidently about, was interested in Afghanistan between 2001 and 2002 and between 2009 and 2010. And that was it. Mm-hmm. Particularly in the last few years, it's been very hard to get people interested in Afghanistan. There's a sense that, this has just been a conflict that's been going on forever.
Right.
You know, and if you do get people talking about Afghanistan, it's very simplistically criticizing the Afghan government and then leaving it at that, essentially. So for instance, I had an article in the latest issue of Harper's about torture mm-hmm. committed by the Afghan police. And it's hard to get people to be interested in, non-American actors doing bad things, even though they're being mm-hmm. aided and abetted by the United States. So that's definitely a big problem.
I think that actually goes right to a question I know Alex and I had discussed a bit. Working to make your writing, and I guess this is more on the book, commercially viable and readable. Did that Afghan war fatigue at all influence the writing process that you went through for the book? 2009 is right around that kind of interest point that you just referenced, but coming out in 2014, outside of that, did you ever run into any of that, or did you essentially, were there points where you wanted to be more technical or dive deeper into a point and you thought it best maybe to skip that?
Or as a corollary of that, was there pressure to insert yourself into the narrative as like the American mediated voice that, Americans can't read about Afghans, like purely about Afghans. They need to read it through an American's eyes, whatever.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, in the first draft of the book, I wasn't present at all.
Wow.
And, it was... people argued with me that I need to be present. on one level, just to sort of act as a guide to a place that would be very foreign to Americans. But on another level, there was a sense that this has to be an American story. There has to be some American there for people to be able to identify with. And I tried to resist that as much as possible. So I tried to insert myself only when it was necessary to sort of move things along. But, you know, I was very conscious about the fact that Afghanistan's a hard sell. And so I focused on stories that I thought would be compelling, regardless of whether they were from Afghanistan or anywhere, and so that influenced sort of the people that I chose to follow, because I thought they had very compelling stories. And there were a number of places where I really wanted to go into, you know, some more technical details and look at some of the more recent scholarship about Afghanistan that either I had to hold back or that it was edited out because it was felt that it would not be accessible to people. In the end, I would say that was the right move, even though that, unfortunately, I think that sacrifices, you sacrifice something important by doing that too.
What prompted you to think, you know, hey, I think I could write a book here? Was it some kind of...
And fortune.
Yeah, fame and fortune. Oh, okay, yeah, that's great. You know, what was there something in the discourse that essentially you thought you could add
hubris,
to something that
stupidity,
was missing?
Mostly.
I mean, your book, in the reviews that were published of your book, you know, the one thing that came across as an observation more than anything else was that you really kind of put a face and at least a name, a very memorable name, to some of these Taliban actors. Was that kind of the intention, was to say, listen, you know, not that, you know, we're all people here or all kind of a message like that, but, you know, here are the people who are responsible for this and here's kind of the relationship between them and here's the story of their lives?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't just... in terms of the Taliban, but more generally speaking, and Alex will know as well, but from living in southern Afghanistan, sort of the stories that you hear and the conversations you have tend to be very different from what you get in the media, just because people don't go out there and talk to them, right? And so an example of that is if you want to ask Afghans, let's say in a place like Kandahar, why there's fighting, why the Taliban was resurgent, you know, you get a number of views. But, you know, they sort of these views cluster around ideas that you tend not to hear about in the West, which is that the Taliban were kicked out of power after 2001, and they are, as all terrorists do, they sort of regroup and they continue to fight, and this is a purely sort of ideological struggle between two sides. But it turns out to be much more complicated. You know, when you go to villages in Kandahar where there's been, you know, night raids, or there's been people who've been falsely accused of being members of the Taliban, or there have been Taliban members themselves who've tried to reconcile and have been rebuffed, it actually turns out to be a much more complicated picture. And I felt that picture wasn't really being related in anything that I'd read, so I wanted to try to do that in a book form.
It's probably a separate conversation to be had about the problems with Western reporting on foreign countries. But I know you... and you explain this in the book, but just as an overview, you know, when you arrived in Afghanistan, you weren't really reporting for anyone established. You had very little money, so you spent some time learning Dari, and you know, you had a lot of time to kind of wander around and get to know the place. And you know, is this how much do you think this helped your reporting, you know, versus the traditional way, which is to do, you know, more or less everything through fixers, not to speak the language, even if, you know, you've been supposedly reporting on Afghanistan for 20, 30 years or whatever. How much of a difference do you think that stuff makes?
Oh, I think it makes all the difference in the world. I mean, there's this sort of inherent tendency to confirmation bias that's embedded in reporting, where you will seek out the sort of people that are just like you, you know, similar class background, similar language ability, you know, and maybe I would have done the same thing if I had come in a different circumstance. But, you know, like Alex said, I kind of showed up there. I just switched careers, so I just showed up there and didn't really have the resources to hire a fixer. You know, the going rate for a fixer when I landed there was like $100 to $150 a day. So it was prohibitively expensive. So, you know, what I ended up doing, basically out of necessity, I learned the language. And what that did is it gave me access to different types of communities. You know, I remember taking a motorcycle trip early on from Kabul to Kandahar and living, you know, along the way, living with elders and taking advantage of Afghan hospitality. And seeing
what year did you do that?
Well, I did it in 2008, and it was a kind of a terrible idea to do it. But I didn't really know any foreigners, so there's no one to really talk me out of it.
To give some context to that, when I first went in 2004, I would always, you know, travel the ring road. I would always fly into Iran and then go to Herat and then go Mazar, Kabul, Kandahar, Herat, and then back out through Iran, always on buses and stuff. And even back in 2004, which were kind of glory days in terms of security, you know, people were saying, you'll die if you get onto, you know, if you go to this next place. And
right.
It's all horrible. And I was doing that all the way up until 2010. So, language is important. I mean, it's kind of a leading question, or it's a question which...
Also, in terms of the class background of the people that I ended up hanging out with, you know, you'd get people that were from villages that not only didn't speak English, but also didn't have the sort of cultural vocabulary that's in common with people who speak English. They just completely operated in a different way, and so that was very interesting and educational for me to see, because then you'd really get into sort of different narratives for why the fighting took place, for example, or what they thought about the Taliban, for instance, or what they thought about various other groups.
But I mean, you've also to kind of put that in context a bit, you know, you've also reported from places where you didn't speak the language. I mean, I don't know how. I know you spent a little bit of time studying Arabic, but you've reported from Syria and stuff. How was that different for you?
It was a big difference, and reporting in Syria was frustrating for that reason, because, I mean, when you rely on translators, sort of the interview becomes very structured, but, with, you know, some of the most interesting things that I found in Afghanistan was just kind of sitting in a room with a bunch of people and people just talking, you know, not in a formal interview context, you know? So all of that wasn't there for me in Syria, and so I'm sure I must have missed a lot of important things, and that's why I think it's really sort of crucial to learn a language. And you know, I say that, and yet I don't speak Arabic, and I'm reporting on the Middle East. But yeah, I think it makes a tremendous difference in sort of the quality of your reporting.
And in general, what would you say? I mean, I know you don't plan to, for instance, write another book about Afghanistan.
Oh God, no.
But, let's say you in a few years' time you decide to work on another book. What kind of things have you taken away from the process that you either do differently or yeah?
Well, first off, I think that if I would write another book, let's say about some part of the Arab world, I would need to go and live there, immerse myself in the way I did in Afghanistan, learn the language, and really try to get a feel for the place, you know, as a sort of prerequisite for even thinking about writing a book about a place like that. And because that's sort of born out of my experience in Afghanistan. It's probably the first sort of broad lesson. And secondly, in terms of specifically writing the book, I mean, I've learned a lot of lessons about storytelling and what things may work and what things may not work as well, for example, that I'd probably take forward into another project.
Such as
not having sort of a too finely interwoven narrative, trying not to jump back and forth between dates too much. You know, I think I probably did that too much in my book, sort of moving between sort of time registers. You know, I think those are sort of important things to think about. You know, there's also a question of how to deal with people's memories in a way that's different than perhaps how I did it in my book. And I'm still trying to think through that, but I think there's other ways to do that than sort of straight reconstructions.
Very interesting. Actually, you just touched on the next thing we'd actually like to talk with you about, which is pulling together these kinds of information. In each of these podcasts, what we're hoping to do is get a fair bit of information about kind of the information sources and kind of your general information consumption patterns. That sounds a bit academic, but essentially, what do you read? How do you put these kinds of things together? What are your research tools? For someone, trying to research the Middle East or Afghanistan and Central Asia, or quantum physics, your earlier work, where do you start? Do you just sort of start at the newspaper or media level and then start diving down there? Or do you start going after, for example, the Twitter feeds of people who are on the ground and kind of giving you the blow-by-blow? Or is it a combination of all of these things?
I can give you a couple of examples. I'm planning to go to Libya at some point this fall. And so one of the things I did recently is I set up a list on Twitter of people that are tweeting interesting things about Libya. And it's following it pretty regularly. And more generally, I get almost all my news from Twitter, by the way. So if something isn't...
Interesting. Say, in contrast to, like links to news stories and all this, or do you rely primarily on kind of this firsthand narrative account of, this is what it's like to stand right here, we'll leave the heavy analysis to someone else?
No, I mean links to news. I mean both, but particularly links. I used my Twitter feed to help curate my news source, essentially, and filter it for me. So,
How is Twitter filtering things? Twitter is like I find Twitter to be a complete flood. I'm waiting for like the great like web, whatever we're on, 6.0, which will tell me what are the interesting things from this like avalanche of mixed metaphors.
Well, it also depends how many people you follow, I think, partly. But I only follow a couple hundred for that reason.
We'll come back to that. You have a very interesting approach to this.
But, if you think about news as everything that's out there that's being published on the internet and otherwise, then it's a flood. And then if you think about the few hundred people that you follow as sort of looking at all that stuff and picking the most interesting things that they think are most interesting and sending that to you, that is a type of filtering, right? And so in that sense, or let's take the Libya example, right? So I have this Libya list. It probably has 10 or 15 people, and they mostly consist of journalists and maybe a couple of analysts who are based in Libya. And so what they do is they tweet what's happening, but they also send, and they're mostly journalists that whose work I respect, so they're sending links that are worth reading. And so for me, that's the first step. And so I usually end up reading all of that every day to prepare. And I'm also very interested in trying to get at sort of deeper, more sort of structural understandings of places, which helped me a lot in Afghanistan. And so I do tend to read a lot of sort of academic work on countries, either journal articles or books, which may not necessarily go into anything I report, but it helps me sort of get a sort of broader and deeper understanding of the place.
As there's, when you go into particularly a foreign country, it can kind of seem like, wow, I really need to know everything. I need to know, all the names of all the cities and then actually maybe some of the villages to just try and get your head around what's happening. The criticism, obviously, of academic publishing sometimes is that it's kind of an inch wide and mile deep. How important is it to kind of stay general, getting in deep, in depth in some issues, but kind of always still saying like, okay, I'm staying connected to what's happening?
Yeah, I think that's right. It depends on what the issue at hand is. So for example, like Libya itself is an extraordinarily broad subject, right? And so just going and reading all like academic work in Libya would be not feasible. But I can give you an example. A couple of years ago, I was in Syria, and I went up to Idlib governorate, to a couple of towns, Binish, and in Taftanaz, just like 2 days before I had arrived, there was a big massacre committed by the Assad army. And so I hooked up with some activists, and we decided to go in to see the aftermath of this massacre. And so what I ended up doing for the next 2 days essentially is going through LexisNexis and other sources and finding everything I could possibly find about Tufte Naas and Binish, these two towns. And it turned out that actually by doing that, I found out that there was a whole history of the Muslim Brotherhood in this village, Tufte Naas, and how they had been very prominent among this one family, the Ghazal family in Tufte Naas, and that family had borne the brunt of the 82 attack against the Muslim Brotherhood by the Assad Senior. And so, and I read a little bit about that. And so then, having that sort of background, when I went into Tufte Naas, I was able to ask all sorts of questions about politics, about the Muslim Brotherhood, that I wouldn't have gotten otherwise. Because it seemed as if, without knowing that, it seemed as if what Assad had done is just gone into Tufte Naas and sort of killed everybody from this one family. And you say, okay, why did he do that? It turns out there's a history there. This one family had been allied with the Muslim Brotherhood in the past, and so therefore, and they had killed some members of the Assad family back in the early 80s. And so there was a sort of another level to this, which I think I was only able to get at by going through some of the Lexis archives and some of the academic work.
So in that instance, essentially, it was a healthy combination of, knowing the terrain, and knowing everything that was published kind of previously, but then actually, being there and knowing the people. So kind of combining, LexisNexis and Twitter seems like a pretty powerful combination then.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all about knowing which questions to ask,
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the biggest challenge of anywhere you go. And that's why I think it's important to be able to get at this information before you go in.
So to be specific, what are the things in a, just a little bit of context? And I think you used to have this rule where you would only follow 100 people on Twitter. You said this was your limit. The rest you shoved into
I've kind of broken that rule now.
List. I see now you're following 207 people.
So yeah, I guess there's two the strictness philosophies of about all this. One is who you follow, Alex.
I'm completely opposite. I think I follow like 1,500 people.
Twitter is a stream that you dip into.
Yeah, exactly. And occasionally, you'll see something interesting, but I have various other kind of filters where, for example, I have a service which every morning will send me the most shared stories of the day among those 1,500 people. So if I don't dip in, at least I will know, the five things which blew up that day, which everyone was reading.
Is this Nuzzle?
I forget its name. I'll put it in show notes. So if I'm away from Twitter for a long time, at least I'll have a sense of kind of what I missed. But who do you find consistently interesting and on Twitter?
That's a interesting question. I'm pulling up my Twitter list right now just to see. Let's say, for example, in Libya, Chris Stephen, who his Twitter handle is Reporting Libya, and I find him just to be very useful because he's somebody who tweets out the most important news on Libya. And so if you're somebody like me who's not living in Libya and who's kind of interested in what's happening but can't really read like 100 articles every day, he's really good at sort of curating all of the articles and so sending out the most important ones of what happened in a given day. So I think
And from Afghanistan?
From Afghanistan, beyond Alex Strick.
Who isn't in Afghanistan and who hasn't been there for a very long time.
Some of the people I like in Afghanistan are Afghan journalists who are based in some of the regional areas. So, for example, Timur Shah, he's in Kandahar, and he tweets interesting things. For example, he tweeted I think last month about a boycott the journalists were doing against the Afghan government and against the police chief Abdul Razak. And so far as I know, that kind of stuff never made it into the news. But I found it very interesting.
And he's the New York Times correspondent.
I think he's a he might be a stringer or something.
Or a stringer.
Yeah. But
yeah.
So yeah, Timur Shah is very good.
He always has interesting little things. Like yesterday, I think there was something on like a grape blockade and which grapes were going off. Like stuff that yeah, you would never read about normally.
Exactly.
In kind of mainstream media. And who else? I mean, who, you know, from reporting from Afghanistan, is there anyone who, if they wrote a story, you would always read it?
I'm a big fan of Matt Aikens. I usually read his stories. Who else? I think, you know, honestly, unfortunately, I think the quality of reporting isn't great. And it goes back to what we were saying before, because, you know, people aren't really going out and getting outside the city for the most part. So this is a big problem. The Afghan Analyst Network consistently has good stuff. Borhan Osman, who sometimes does reporting for AAN, or he does like analysis too. And
mini reports, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he went to Kandahar, I think, last year or the year before and did some pretty compelling, interesting stuff from there. I like him. But unfortunately, I think it's a commentary on things right now in Afghanistan where there's not a lot of... there's not a lot of great reporting coming out of there, I think. Part of it also is there's less interest from news organizations, less resources. I think less people are traveling there, less reporters are traveling there as well.
Are there any websites that, I mean, outside Afghanistan, outside even the kind of the whole reporting on foreign things, you and I share articles and hardly any of them are about Afghanistan. They're often about a whole, well, defies categorization, but like I know you follow what is it, Three Quantum Quarks or Three, I forget the name of it,
Three Quarks Daily. Yeah, I mean, if we're talking outside of Afghanistan, actually, there's a lot of interesting things. So, Three Quarks Daily is a really great website that itself is a sort of curated, you know, it's like a source of curating other material on the web. And they do a mix of science and literature and politics and philosophy. And they, you know, consistently have like good things. And you can sign up for their mailing list, and they'll send you like every day sort of 10 of the most interesting things on the web. You know, some of my interests outside of Afghanistan and the Middle East have to do with science and science reporting. And so I follow a lot of that kind of thing. There's a guy on Twitter called The Medical Skeptic who's really interesting because what he does is he's basically tweeting out correctives to studies that you see every day. You know, like the big study that was out yesterday, I think, Alex, was the
carbohydrate study.
The carbohydrate study, right, that low-carb diets are, you can lose weight more effectively than you can in a low-fat diet, for instance, you know. And it partly because of poor journalism and partly because of the problems endemic to the way science is done these days, you know, there's a lot of really shoddy studies that are out there that have influence on people. And so this guy, Medical Skeptic, is one of a... There's another one who I follow called Neural Skeptic, who does the same thing for, like, neuroscience. And so these guys are really good at sort of providing sort of sober analyses and correctives on the studies that are published all the time.
It really does seem like it's... each day you wake up with a brand new kind of pseudoscience thing, you know, that attacks conventional wisdom or is a radically new look at something like this, but... a lot of it seems, when you scratch the surface, to not hold much water. I'm wondering if we could talk even just briefly about books. You know, obviously we're consuming, you know, a lot of things digitally or you know, on Twitter, on websites, and all these kinds of things. You know, where do you, assuming you read books fairly frequently, you know, how do you choose what you read next? Or is there any place you go to in particular for recommendations, or is it just kind of like, do you skim bestsellers? Or obviously, I'm sure it depends by topic, but yeah, I think probably best. How do you choose what you read next?
Well, actually, I make a lot of use of Goodreads, and so I have like mm-hmm. 8 or 9 friends or something on Goodreads, and so and I believe I'm friends with both of you, I think. And so when they read something, you know, and they it comes to my email.
You've never read a book that I've read.
No, that's not true. That's not true. I have. I just haven't posted anything on Goodreads for a long time. I haven't posted the books that I've read on Goodreads for a long time.
Ah, you're clandestine.
Yeah, yeah, I just I'm behind on that. But no, I do. I get recommendations all the time, and I have a massive and growing Amazon wish list based on these things. So that's probably like the most consistent source for me. Is that? I mean, there's another website that's also like this social reading. I think it's called Library Thing.
Library Thing.
Library Thing. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of clunky and it's not as well designed, I think, as Goodreads. But I was using that for a while too, for the same purpose.
Do you read a lot of books? Like, because you don't post them, I have no sense of how many books like you read. Sometimes I either think that you're reading 200 books a year or you're reading five.
No, I do read a lot of books, but I have actually I've changed the method in which I read, so I've slowed down a little bit. One of the things I'm doing now.
Tell us about your method.
Well, it's called it's a variation of the Feynman method. Essentially, it's from Richard Feynman, the great physicist. Who died, I guess, in the 1980s. And you know, his approach was to... I mean, he had an approach on how to remember things that you read, essentially. And it's really very simple, but it is... every time I get to a section break, I will kind of close the book and try to summarize everything that I read in that section to myself. And then when I get to the end of the chapter, I will do the same thing. And I'll also take notes. In DevonThink, which is the program I use for notes, and so I try to have like a very basic and sort of straightforward set of notes for a chapter. And the idea of those notes is that I don't want it to be a reference that I can use later, even though it does become that. But the idea is that I should be able to close that program and walk outside and pick somebody out in the street and basically make the argument to them about what or sort of repeat the argument of the chapter. Or the content of the chapter, the most important points, in such a way that they can get something out of it. And so doing that, it turns out, actually has slowed down my reading a little bit, because I'm actually right now sometimes reading things twice, you know, to make sure I get things correct. But I feel like I've actually retained significantly much more by doing that than I did before.
Are you... with this, okay, so you have this method where essentially you are restating the point to yourself, which studies have shown that this helps you, you know, recall things in a better way. Are you doing anything else with this information? Are you you mentioned DevonThink, which is a great love and passion of mine, you know, which is essentially how to describe it, Evernote on steroids. Even though I hate the description of things being on steroids, but
Evernote's with electricity.
Yes, you know, so you're taking notes. Are you, you know, taking note of certain quotes from the book? Assuming you're reading things electronically, what are you doing with those quotes? Are you just storing them away somewhere for a future day, or?
So once it's in DevonThink, and so the things I put in DevonThink are the basic. I try to get at the chain of reasoning and the argument, if it is that type of book, and any sort of concepts that are interesting, and occasionally a quote or something. And then I'll have that in a file in DevonThink, and then I'll try to extract out of that the most useful concepts or chains of reasoning, and I put that into Anki, the note card program, and Anki uses spaced repetition, so it will it sort of uses an algorithm to maximize your retention, essentially. So it'll show you note cards when you're about to forget them, you know, it'll test you when you're about to forget a piece of information. And so,
why is that important?
Well, studies have shown that that this way of remembering things is much more effective. You know, we have this, I guess it's called like a curve of forgetting, where, you know, you learn some piece of information and your retention of that piece of information basically exponentially decays as time goes on. And so if you're strategic about when you review that information, then you can increase your retention ability very much so. And that's sort of what Anki does. And so it's very convenient because you know it'll have you put in the note cards and it will know when to show you which note card, essentially. So your only job is to say whether you know it or not.
So you're putting quotes and concepts into there, or what is it you're putting in?
Never quotes. But I do put in concepts, or I do put in chains of reasoning. So I can give you an example. I'm reading a book now called The Myth of Religious Violence, and it's a book that is making the argument that religious systems of belief aren't any more prone to violence than secular systems. And also it's making the argument that even the very idea that there's such a thing called religion that is transcultural and transhistorical probably doesn't make that much sense. That really, when you talk about religion, you have to contextualize it. You know, like what counts as a religion today may not count as a religion in some other time or some other place, right? That's kind of the argument. And so he has certain specific concepts related to that about religion, like and certain sort of arguments related to that. So I'll take that and I have that in the Devon Think, and then I put that into note cards. So for example, his argument that the argument I just repeated to you that religion isn't sort of a thing that is the same everywhere, that it actually, what counts as a religion depends on the place and time. For example, we in the United States, we have this idea that there's such a thing as a secular Jew. And we don't have the idea really that there's such a thing as a secular Muslim. It's considered like a contradiction in terms, you know? And so he'll ask, like, you know, why is that the case? And maybe it's because our very understanding of what we think of as religion is probably problematic. So, you know, I'll put like that example, for instance, in Devon Think, and then it'll end up in Anki.
Right. So, I mean, all of this is essentially, you know, you're not, or at least it doesn't sound like you're reading for a particular project or something you're working on. You're just reading to expand your knowledge and understanding in a general sense. And do you have any kind of way of consistently working on skills? I mean, I know you've dabbled is the wrong word, but you've kind of been studied and looked at kind of programming for a while. I know you've had some involvement and study of kind of memorization techniques. Is there kind of an overall plan for how you move on to the next skill, or is it just whatever takes your fancy at that particular time? Or
it's really whatever takes my fancy. Or often I end up at one thing because it was required, or it came out of something else I was looking into. I mean, as an example of skills, last year I learned Python, and this summer I finished a course at Udacity. I'm big on doing these online courses. I think they're really fun and interesting. And so Udacity has a course. Go ahead.
No, just if there are any that you'd recommend.
Yeah, so I've been doing the computer science track in Udacity, starting with Computer Science 101.
CS 101. Yeah.
Which I think you did too. And that's that basically teaches you how to create your own search engine. And it's sort of just a fun way to get at learning how to use Python. So I did that. And the course I'm taking now, or I just finished, is it's about algorithms. And it teaches you social networks. So basically it teaches you all the sort of algorithms that are used in social network analysis and network theory. And so, you know, there's particular concepts and there's particular types of algorithms which I put into Devon Think, and I essentially memorize and put into Anki. And I think that, and I believe that, like, we should err on the side of memorizing over not memorizing, you know? when I studied physics in college, and my professors would always say, don't memorize anything, just, you know the concepts. I actually think that's wrong, and actually it's really useful to memorize or a lot of things, because when you do that, when you have that sort of type of knowledge, you're able to make sort of connections that you weren't able to make before, or you wouldn't necessarily be able to make if you had to look everything up.
It's like, you know, the same thing which when you talk to, I wouldn't say everyone, but certainly a lot of Muslims will say, well, you know, you can't understand Islam, firstly, until you've learned Arabic, B, until you've kind of started memorizing the Quran.
Absolutely. And
yeah, Anand, I'm just really happy you raised that issue. I was actually told much the same thing. It definitely wasn't physics class, but still history and international relations. There really was this emphasis of, you know, no, it's okay. You don't need to actually memorize a whole lot. You know, just the big things, the general concepts, and all this. And I completely agree with everything you just said. Actually, once you have a basis of memorization for things, this lets you draw just an incredible amount of new connections with information, and lets your sort of the depth of your understanding go much deeper. And then all of a sudden, once you have that established, those kinds of big concepts that are stressed make a whole lot more sense. You know, obviously this is particularly useful for history, but I'd imagine even physics or journalism as well.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a firm believer now that memorization is a key component to creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Or in other words, having knowledge, detailed knowledge of things is important for creativity. You know, the sociologist Andrew Abbott was once wrote something about engineering, and he talked about the two different types of engineers there are. One is the type that sees the differences between things, and the other is the type that sees the sort of similarities between things. And both are really useful. And lead to sort of different kinds of end states in engineering. And I believe I'm much more of the latter. I tend to see the similarities between things. And so for that, you know, it's really important for me to actually have a lot of things on recall that I can pull up to be able to make those connections.
Do you worry? I know we've talked about this in the past a lot of bits. You spent, and I think you're continually kind of looking at this, but I do worry that if as you self-identify kind of as someone who sees patterns in things quite easily, do you worry about making conclusions about things too early, confirmation bias, all of that kind of stuff?
absolutely. Yeah, this is it's a great question, because you know, I'm sure I've sort of seeing certain things as being similar when they're probably not. And it's a hard balance to strike, I guess, you know? This is why it's important to sort of match a general knowledge of things with, like, an expertise on certain particular subjects.
Because, I mean, that's my argument for, to take it full circle, that's my argument for having 1,500 Twitter followers. If I only have a very small number of people that I'm exposed to, I'm kind of filtering my way into, and I'm kind of funneling myself down, and I'm very unlikely to see something weird or random or, something outside. You know, I'm pre-selecting the kinds of things that I want, or the kinds of conversations or attitudes and stuff that I want to be exposed to.
No, that's absolutely right. You know, I use an app called Random, which I think you maybe you did, or somebody sent this to me. But
that just got launched a few days ago.
Yeah. I've been using this app, and it's great, because what it does is it just sort of categorizes information on the web by subject, and you can click through and read what you want. But then it'll try to burst your filter bubble every once in a while by throwing in something random or different, or something you wouldn't read otherwise, and It's actually really addictive, because you keep clicking through and you read one article and then you're done with the article, and then it basically pulls up on the screen a bunch of categories, you know, like terrorism, ISIS, ideology, health, you know, and then you pick a category and then you read an
but
article.
But also some random ones.
And then some random ones, right. And it's been really fun. And actually, I think I that might be a way for me to sort of cut against the problems that I acknowledge or with my Twitter habits.
So, you know, looking back at the things you've discussed this far. You know, it's physics in college, and actually a book on physics in 2004, and then, you know, flash forward a decade, it's a book on Afghanistan. You know, I'm hearing a consistent theme of, you know, memory, study, you know, kind of improvement, learning, you know, as best you can about a wide variety of topics. But, you know, something Alex and I are always interested in is kind of this idea of coherence. You know, what would you say to somebody, you know, who looked at your CV and said, this guy's done a lot of, you know, very interesting things, but I don't see the connection between, you know, physics in Afghanistan. Is there a connection, or is it just, you know, what would you say to something like that?
I think there's no connection, actually. And, you know, my view is life's too short to spend, you know, completely immersed in just one particular subject.
Specialization is for insects.
Specialization is for insects, as a famous quote goes. You know, for me, my ideal way of working is, you know, I pick a subject or a topic, and I try to delve into it as much as I can for a couple of years, try to come up with something useful about it, and then move on to something else.
How do you choose what you move on to then?
It's just really whatever moves me. I'm really interested in science reporting and the way science is sort of thought about in the public. You know, just because, like, every day you open up the newspaper and there's some study that says something that perhaps contradicts the same thing, you know, contradicts something that said 2 days before, you know? Coffee's good for you, coffee's bad for you, things like that. And we use studies now almost like in the way like people in some other cultures use religion. Like it's just, if there's a study behind something, then it becomes a certain type of truth that's unquestioned. So I'm interested in those kinds of questions. And so I would love to do something about that, write about science reporting, write about sort of the abuse of science. There's a doctor named Ioannidis, actually is his pronunciation. He's a professor at Stanford, and he wrote a paper back in 2004 that said that, I think the title was something like, Why Every Major Published Medical Finding is False. And what he did is he went back and looked at sort of the most important and biggest biomedical studies and found out that most of them couldn't be replicated, in fact. And since then, he's been doing that for a lot of other fields. He just came out with one in neuroscience, and also there's in psychology. Some of the foundational studies in psychology in the last 20 years, it turns out they can't be replicated. And so this is a really interesting thing for me, and I'd love to go into that some more.
Do you ever find that you know, essentially what you're talking about there is kind of myth busting, or, you know, showing something which everyone believes to be a certain way to be false? And I've to some extent, the work that I've done, certainly the book that I did on the kind of Taliban Al Qaeda relationship, wasn't so much a creative project as a destruction of stuff that other people had said in the past. Do you have an opinion as to, you know, I find it kind of boring to do projects where all you're doing is ripping other people's work to pieces rather than kind of writing something new.
I mean, I agree with you. I think that's right. I think that the way I conceive of this, I mean, this is in a very initial stage, but the way I conceive of this project is trying to look at the way science is done and what it says about something like human nature. That's sort of the thing I'm interested in. And so a lot of these studies are about human beings and what human beings are supposedly doing or what they used to do 10,000 years ago in the savannah and what that means about how they should act today and stuff. But there is another sort of strand of science that says much more interesting and sophisticated things. So my approach would be not just to sort of tear this stuff down, but to try to promote a different way of looking at this stuff. Which I think, you know, honestly, it's going back to Matt's question, that there is some coherence there then between that and Afghanistan. I was interested in Afghanistan and cutting against particular narratives and showing that there are other ways of thinking about Afghanistan.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, to get to something a bit more closer to reality, if that even means anything. You have to start by cutting down things. Just to kind of clear the field.
Yeah.
Finally, some quick short things. I asked you, I'm not sure whether you did it, but if you have a book, a film, and a song you'd like to recommend to people.
Yes, I do. Okay, so as for a film, I just saw this a couple of days ago, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, which is a Ken Loach film about the IRA and the Irish Republican struggle in 1920 or 1921. And it's a really classic movie. And, I've been thinking a lot about revolutions recently, obviously, because of everything that's in the news. And so some of the things I've been reading and watching have had to do with that. And it's a really beautiful and inspiring film. I think it's a good antidote. I mean, if you see all the terrible things that are happening in the world that's come out of these revolutions, to watch this film, I think it's inspiring. So I'd recommend that. So the book is by Victor Serge, who was a Russian revolutionary. He was an anarchist who moved to Russia after the revolution and joined the Bolsheviks and became a leading proponent of the revolution. He eventually became disillusioned and fled the country and was hounded by Stalin's agents and died in penury. And he wrote a series of novels, one of which was recently just translated and put out into English. It's called The Unforgiving Years, and it's about these revolutionary activists dealing with the fact that the revolution that they believed in so fervently was betraying its ideals. And kind of a tragic book, and it obviously resonates with the experiences of my friends in Egypt and people I've met in Syria, so I thought it was timely.
And for your song?
And my song, I just discovered this song from one of my favorite bands called the Alabama Three, which is like seven guys from, I think, London. And they did the Sopranos theme song, by the way, so that's what the sort of their claim to fame. But they have a song, came out a couple years ago, but I just discovered it called Vietnamistan. And it's a good song, but among other things, it gets props from me for being the only song that I know of in popular music that references Helmand and the Taliban.
I will add all this to show notes.
Closing this out, Anand, I really appreciate you taking the time. We have two final questions. I'll do the first one. Alex has the second one. What is the book you've given most often as a gift to other people?
This is a book by Guy Deutscher, who's a linguist. I think I gave it to you, Alex, didn't I, as a gift?
I read it on your recommendation, yeah.
Okay. I've given this to like 9 people. It's my favorite book of all time, and it's called The Unfolding of Language. And essentially, it's just a sort of the history of how language works and how it came to be. And I know that sounds very boring, but it's actually a thrilling, extraordinary book.
I should add that it's an acquired taste. When I have a book club with 5 or 6 people, and we read books. We take a month or two to read them. And when it was my turn to pick the book, I picked this book, and I killed the book club. And no one read a book for 7 months, and we've only just restarted. And ironically, we're starting up with your book, Anand.
I don't know what all this says about my life, but it's probably not a good thing.
Okay, final question. If you could pick any period in all history, where would you time travel to?
Oh, well, given everything I'm reading and watching now, I would say 1917. I'd like to go back to the Russian Revolution and maybe take an ice pick and assassinate Stalin.
Well, that actually does it for the questions from our end. Anon, everybody listening, we of course recommend sincerely that you go out and buy and read Anand Gopal's book, No Good Men Among the Living. It is available at your local bookstore and is an excellent read. Anand, thank you so much for taking the time to come on.
Thanks for having me.
For our listeners, this recording and more information about the tools discussed in it is all available on our website one last time at sourcesandmethods.com. Thanks for listening.